It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll meet two writers who spent a year in the wilderness of the Boundary Waters to chronicle its fragile beauty.
First, open enrollment for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, begins tomorrow. This enrollment period has largely flown under the radar because of the ongoing political fight over the health care law.
This year, the enrollment period is shorter, and there's been a lot of uncertainty over the future of the markets and the law itself.
Bobby Peterson is with us now. He's executive director of ABC for Health here in Wisconsin. Bobby, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
If you had one message you wanted to have out there about this enrollment period, Bobby, what would it be?
Shop around. Get onto the website. If you're looking for coverage, there are still some bargains out there to be had. And the advanced premium tax credits are still available for people. So there are some affordable options for people.
There's been talk that there's going to be, under the Trump administration, less publicity and outreach for this enrollment period. What are you seeing compared to the last couple of years?
Sure. It's a lot more suppressed, shorter time periods. The marketplace is going to be closed on most of Sundays for maintenance. That's on weekends when people are might have a little more time to look into some of these issues. So it's definitely a shorter time period. But on the plus side, this isn't our first rodeo. We've been through this a few times, so I think people are a little more aware of what to do and how to get through the process.
I want to talk about a few different groups, and I want to start with people who are currently covered under the Affordable Care Act marketplace coverage. People might be out there thinking, all right, I've got coverage. I can just let it ride for next year. I don't need to do anything. True or false?
False. I think you need to go check your plan and see if that plan is still available. You could potentially get auto-enrolled into something that you're not. You wouldn't be suited for you, so it's good to go in there, look at your plan options. You might find something that's even more affordable, and your plan might not be available. Some plans left the marketplace in Wisconsin.
And when you say get in there and check it out, where do people go? What's the best resource for them to start shopping around, making sure their plan is still going to be around?
Yes, healthcare.gov. It's the website for the marketplace. They can window shop. They don't have to make a decision, look at the plan options that are available, look at your plan that you had, and gives you some real good options to review and choose what's best for you or your family.
Is there help available for people who are less technology savvy? We've heard about this the last couple of years, people not really connected to the internet that well. Any help out there for them?
Yeah, unfortunately, those resources were reduced also by the Trump administration. Wisconsin had healthcare navigators. We still have healthcare navigators at Covering Wisconsin www.coveringwisconsin.org. There's information on their website. There's navigators that are out there. Healthcare providers in some communities have certified application counselors. Health departments have folks that can help with some of these issues. And even, going to the public library, the librarians have been around this issue now for several years, and they can at least point you in the right direction.
Talking to Bobby Peterson from ABC for Health, looking at the new enrollment period for coverage under the Affordable Care Act that starts tomorrow. And Bobby, how about people who are currently covered and receiving subsidies? If they follow the news, it's been a confusing up and down over the last year or so. What do they need to know about whether they're still going to be able to afford this coverage?
Well, I think, there is confusion, and people have heard that, about the cost-sharing reductions. That's a separate category of assistance. You're still eligible for them. The insurance companies still have to provide them. They had to increase their cost. A lot of them targeted the silver plans for price increases. So some of the gold and bronze plans in Wisconsin they're a pretty good deal for folks. But the advanced premium tax credits are still available. Those haven't changed. They provide significant subsidies for most of the people. The vast majority of people that apply for this coverage are eligible for advanced premium tax credits, and that can make your insurance very affordable.
As I understand it, there are people who can use the marketplace but make too much money to be able to get the subsidies. What might they see when it comes to premiums this year?
Well, the premiums have gone up. It depends on the type of plan that they select. Certainly, if they're selecting silver plans, they're going to be going up to 36% in Wisconsin is the estimate, but that's an average. So it's still worth getting in there, looking at what your options are, and you know, making sure you've evaluated your plans. There's brokers and agents that can that are out there to help you too in some situations. As we said, covering Wisconsin Navigators. There's Navigators in the northern part of the state too, through Northwest Wisconsin SEP. But it's, you know, it's you've got some time, but not too much time. It's going to be, the marketplace closes on the 15th, so you got to get start looking and start shopping.
The 15th of
December.
December.
Okay. December, sorry.
A month and a half. Still pretty soon. And what is the state of coverage right now in Wisconsin? Over the last year, of course, we've heard stories. One company leaves a market here. Somebody else may or may not take up the mantle. Are there options for everybody around the state?
There are. There are options. And, you know, there's a little more limited than they were last year, but there still are options in every county. You know, through the Affordable Care Act, we've been able to provide coverage to several hundred thousand more people in Wisconsin. That's a good thing, because the more people have that have coverage, the less uncompensated care we have in the state. And uncompensated care is not a good thing, because that those expenses, when bills don't get paid, get socialized and redistributed to everybody else's bill. So it's a good idea to have coverage. Get know your health insurance, get your coverage, and it helps everybody out.
I know probably a lot more questions will start coming up tomorrow as people start to try to apply, but are you hearing a lot of questions based on uncertainty given all the political back and forth on this in Washington?
Well, yeah. I mean, there is a lot of political rancor, and, you know, it's hard to, you got to kind of look through all the smoke, distractions, and realize that, you know, the marketplace is still there. The services and the coverage is still there. It hasn't changed yet. There's a lot of proposals out there that things could change down the road. But right now, the main structures are still there for people. Provides a great opportunity to get, you know, affordable health care for moderate income folks. Badger Care Plus might be an option for people that are low income or just losing a job or transitioning to a situation where they don't have any income or resources. The other thing to look into is make sure if you're eligible for disability programs, to evaluate those carefully. And there are some of those that allow you to work as well as get disability Medicaid coverage. So it's important to look at the range of options, get some help from the experts at Covering Wisconsin or your insurance brokers, get some support. You know, get busy, start working on it, and, you know, keep going forward and get that health care coverage.
How can people know if they should be going to healthcare.gov or pursuing Badger Care Plus?
Well, it's going to be based on your income, and, you know, that's a really tricky question, because your income is calculated differently for the marketplace, and it's differently for Badger Care Plus. But it's something that the healthcare navigators can help you with if you're around 100% of the FPL, which is, you know, fairly low, but it's, you know, it's something that, you know, if you're losing your job and your income drops that month, you might be eligible for Badger Care Plus. Some people might move between the marketplace and Badger Care Plus, and that's another confusing area where people can pivot from one program to the other, and you need a little help to make those transitions. We've made it a little more complicated in Wisconsin than it needs to be, unfortunately, but it is, you know, these are important coverage programs that can provide a lot of help when you need them.
And Bobby, before we wrap up, some people might be thinking, okay, they haven't repealed and replaced the Affordable Care Act yet, but, you know, I might apply now by the time it would kick in next year. They may have done so I shouldn't bother. What would you say to that?
No, go forward with your coverage. Nothing that they're going to do is going to, it'd be highly, highly unlikely that it's going to happen that quickly. Even the most radical plans call for some period of transition. You know, the 2018 enrollment period and coverage period is going to remain, and I would not apply for coverage now because you think it's going to be gone. This period is rolling forward, and get your coverage.
Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
That's Bobby Peterson, Executive Director of ABC for Health. He talked to us today about the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act Marketplace that opens tomorrow and runs through December 15th. Information, as he said, at healthcare.gov.
Coming up, we'll meet two writers and adventurers who spent a year in the boundary waters of northern Minnesota. Stay with us here on Central Time. The Boundary Waters Natural Area straddles the line between the United States and northern Minnesota and Ontario. It's a sprawling collection of waterways and bogs loved by canoeists, campers, and anglers.
Our next guest spent a year there to bear witness to its fragile beauty and raise awareness about the dangers posed by a proposed sulfide or copper mining project on the edge of the Boundary Waters.
Amy and Dave Freeman join us now. They're the authors of A Year in the Wilderness, Bearing Witness in the Boundary Waters. They were named Adventurers of the Year in 2014 by National Geographic Magazine, and they're speaking this Sunday at the Wisconsin Book Festival at 10:30 at the Central Library. Amy and Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Well, Amy, let's start with you. When you began, you and Dave weren't what you'd call political. It sounds like you wanted to educate the public about the joys of the wilderness, and that didn't necessarily include political issues or activism. Amy, what got you concerned about the prospect of this copper mine near the Boundary Waters?
Right. Well, the Boundary Waters is a very precious wilderness area to both Dave and myself personally, because it's the first place we were exposed to wilderness as kids. And we work in the area as guides, so canoeing guides in the summer, dog sledding guides in the winter. And, you know, through that, we had been educating people about the wilderness, getting them outdoors, enjoying it. And when we heard about the proposed mines near the edge of the wilderness, that's when we started to get concerned. This type of mining has a terrible track record of polluting ground and surface water.
And Dave, what about you? Is there anything more that made you think this is the time to change and to take more of an activist stance?
Well, I think, you know, in this instance, we really see our jobs and our way of life at risk. This mine would probably bring about 400 jobs to the region, but a recent study shows that over 4,000 jobs could be lost because our wilderness edge economy really relies on this wilderness. And I think the more we learned, the more concerned we got, and we realized that, you know, we aren't lawyers, we don't have a lot of money, we're not scientists. So the way we could get involved was by using our skills of traveling in the wilderness and storytelling, and that's sort of how we got involved. We just wanted to use, you know, the skills that we have to be able to protect this place that's given us so much.
And the both of you have kayaked all over the world. Dave, what is it that makes the Boundary Waters special?
Oh, you know, we've traveled over 30,000 miles by canoe, kayak, and dog sled. We've crossed both North and South America under our own power, and the Boundary Waters is truly like no other place. It's home to timber wolves and bears, some of the best freshwater fishing in the country. The Superior National Forest is 3 million acres. 1 million of that is the Boundary Waters Canary Wilderness. It's the largest wilderness area east of the Rockies and north of the Everglades. And the Superior National Forest contains 20% of all the freshwater in all of our national forests in the entire country. And you can dip your cup right in the lake and drink the water right out of the lake. There are very few places left in this world that are like that, and it's just too precious to risk.
And Amy, tell us how you first decided that what you were going to do is you were going to spend an entire year in the Boundary Waters. How did you come to that decision?
Sure. Well, there were two things that factored in there. Before spending a year in the wilderness, we paddled from the proposed mine site near Ely to Washington, D.C., and that was in the late fall of 2014. And when we did that, we kind of thought, oh, we should do something more. You know, what could we do? And we realized that being in the place would be the most important thing. You know, we could share the place, let others live vicariously through our blog posts and photos and videos that we were posting online.
And that was important to you, this outreach, so you could be completely immersed in the wilderness of the Boundary Waters, but you still had to be reaching out to the rest of the world and showing the world what you were doing. How did you mix kind of the high-tech, low-tech aspect of this, Dave?
Yeah, you know, we saw our portable satellite terminal and a handful of small portable solar panels and, you know, cameras and things like that that we had really as tools, just like we had a tent and sleeping bags and cooking pots. And so, you know, we use them for a specific thing to sort of capture and share the experience. But most of the time we were unplugged. You know, we were doing the things that you would think of doing when you were out camping. So I guess we just tried to be mindful of it. We wanted to use it to sort of share the wilderness, but we didn't want to let those electronics sort of have a negative impact on our experience.
And I got to ask you about the packing and the planning. I mean, I have packed for 2 weeks away, maybe 3 weeks, never an entire year. How do you provision yourself and plan all of that aspect for being in a boat, you know, through different seasons, four different seasons for an entire year, Amy?
Yeah, it was a lot of logistics to iron out before we headed into the wilderness. Fortunately, we had an expedition manager, Levi Lexold, who was working with the Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters. So he did a lot of the behind-the-scenes action for us, like getting resupplies sent in to us, buying groceries, that kind of thing. But before we left, we spent a lot of time organizing our gear so that, you know, Levi knew exactly where it was when it, you know, winter rolled around and it was time to pull out the warm wool socks and the toboggans and stuff like that.
We're talking to Amy and Dave Freeman. They're the authors of A Year in the Wilderness, Bearing Witness in the Boundary Waters. They were named Adventurers of the Year in 2014 by National Geographic magazine. And Dave, let's get into the trip itself. You left in fall, which seems like kind of a rough time to get going because, you know, in the northern parts of the state, fall doesn't always last that long. It's not always very warm, but that's when you set out. What were those first weeks like heading into the colder weather?
Oh, the fall in the Boundary Waters, I think, is our favorite time. You know, after Labor Day, the leaves start changing, it gets cool, there aren't any bugs, and it's a magical time to be in the wilderness. And it does get harder, you know, as the lake starts to freeze. Sort of this time of year, end of October, beginning of November, it is harder in the winter. But you know, we found special things about being out there throughout the whole year. And I think this time of year, as the lakes were freezing, was probably the most challenging time. But it was also our favorite time because, you know, we had to learn new skills that we had never had to do, even in years spent out in wild places from the Amazon to the Arctic, you know, figuring out how we could ram our canoe up onto thin ice and then get out and safely walk across the thin ice and then get back into an unfrozen part 100 yards away. You know, there are all these new challenges that we had to overcome. We had wolves run through our campsite. We had wolves that we could hear fishing across the lake in the rapids, fishing for ciscos that were spawning. And there were all sorts of magical things that happened during this time.
Yeah, the wolves seem like they're a real part of this narrative. You hear them before you see them. What was that like? Is it something that sent a shiver up your spine, or was it just kind of awe and wonder?
I would say awe and wonder. We've traveled in this area for a long time, for most of our lives, by canoe and with dogs in the winter. And so we knew that the wolves, you know, they're not out to get us. But the North Woods is home for the wolves. And so they're an animal we definitely respect, and we're excited anytime we hear or see them.
And Amy, there's a picture of you in the book wearing, it must be like a full body wetsuit, but it doesn't look like what I think of, you know, as a surfing wetsuit, and you're in a little hole in an icy lake. Was that about trying to make sure you stayed safe and warm? I mean, did you ever fear for your survival because temperatures were so cold?
That was part of our safety gear when we were traveling on thin ice. So it's actually a dry suit, which someone would use, you know, paddling a canoe or kayak in cold water. So, yeah, in that photo, I was testing it out, and I was pretty, you know, happy and warm. It's all about, you know, the layers you wear underneath it, and I was staying completely dry in that.
And Dave, you write in the book about the appeal of this trip, and for someone who might not have done this, can you put that into words? What is it you love about being testing your limits and being in this completely wild area and living in a wild way for a year?
You know, I think it's the simplicity. You know, you really, when you travel in the wilderness, it really distills things down to their very essence. You know, it's It's clean water to drink, it's food to eat, a basic shelter, you know, spending time with people that you care about, and having a sense of purpose. You know, we had all of those things, and we didn't really have much else. And I think that's what draws us back over and over to wild places, is because it really brings into sharp focus what's important, what really matters, what we really need in life.
Do you think you met your goal? Did you draw that focus to the beauty of the Boundary Waters, and also why it's important not to take it for granted, Amy?
Yeah, I do think so. Based on feedback we received from, you know, thousands of people via social media, and also the people who came in and met with us while we were there, we actually had over 300 people volunteer to deliver resupplies to us during the course of the year. And we just heard so many touching stories from people who were inspired by what we were doing and who have a really deep love of this place.
Now, I'm from Wisconsin, and I've never been there. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump away, but I've never been to the Boundary Waters. If people read your book and they have this response that I did, and they want to go there themselves, maybe not for a year in a canoe, how can they get started? What's a good way?
Well, the Boundary Waters is our most popular wilderness area. More people visit the Boundary Waters than any other wilderness in the country, and it's been that way ever since the Wilderness Act passed in 1964. It is an amazing wilderness because you see toddlers out there with their parents, and you see people in their 70s, even their 80s. And there's a whole network of outfitters and guides that are set up to help you. So you can rent everything you need, or you can just rent a canoe. You can bring a guide, or you can do a self-guided trip. So it's something that we would encourage everyone to do. So just do a search, you know, Boundary Waters Canoe Trip or Boundary Waters Outfitting, and you can go from there.
Dave and Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Amy and Dave Freeman. They're the authors of A Year in the Wilderness, Bearing Witness in the Boundary Waters. They were named Adventurers of the Year by National Geographic. They'll be speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival at 10:30 a.m. this Sunday in Madison.
There's more coming up here on Central Time.
The policy on transgender service members in the U.S. military has gone back and forth in the last 2 years.
Under the later years of the Obama administration, the Pentagon put an end to a ban on transgender service members. Then, earlier this year, President Trump signed a memo that essentially reinstated that ban.
Now, a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration's effort. The judge found the ban likely unconstitutional and ruled that the Obama-era policy of allowing transgender Americans to serve in the military should stay.
Sherry Swakowski is a retired Army colonel from Wisconsin. She's also the senior out transgender veteran in the country and an advocate for people who are transgender. She's here to share her take on the controversy over that ban. Sherry, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be back with you.
Take us back to July, your initial reaction when President Trump had, in effect, reinstated a ban.
I woke up to check my phone, just kind of was blowing up because of the tweets. Couldn't believe that the commander-in-chief had turned his back on, you know, up to as many as 15,500 transgender service members currently serving in uniform.
And what did that mean? That kind of had a six-month ticking time clock before that would have been enforced. What did that mean for transgender service members that you spoke to after that memo had been signed?
Well, it certainly left them with a feeling of uneasiness. They didn't know if they had been just fired by tweets or if it was going to be something else. And I guess we still don't know for sure.
And what had changed for transgender service members after the Obama administration had made it clear, yes, you can serve and you can serve openly? They were there before that announcement, but now they can serve openly. What was the experience like for them and for the military?
Yes, I mean, we've always been there. We've been serving with members of the LGBT community since the very foundation of our country. When the policy was changed to allow transgender service, it was just like a weight being lifted off of the shoulders of these individuals. So anytime you can eliminate distractors from your job, you'll find that you're able to focus more on it, and you'll do a better job. And that kind of was part of the argument for the folks that were concerned that this was going to be a terrible thing. It was going to have terrible effects on readiness. But when you eliminate detractors, you focus better, your individual performance goes up, and in turn, the unit performance and readiness goes up.
Right. Part of the argument had been that this could be a distraction for non-transgender service members. It was a rolling the dice, kind of a social experiment, it was called. What did we see in practice?
Well, in practice, we found very little issue with it. Just as the RAND study that the Pentagon commissioned, this one-year-long study, had predicted. So we've been serving for almost a year and a half openly, and there have been little to no issues concerning transgender service or our ability to deploy.
And then on a related note, when President Trump announced his policy initially on Twitter, he said the military, and I'm quoting here, must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail. Ending the quote there, and I want to take each of those in turn. You were just talking about concerns over disruption. You think the president was wrong on that point?
Well, you know, I do, and, you know, I put my analyst skills, was an analyst most of my life in the military to include the Pentagon for almost 3 years. And when he opened with, after checking with my generals, or in consultation with my generals, and we come to learn that that really never happened, when the first part of anything you read is false, then you become even more suspect about what follows. And of course, the comments about being disruptive, the comments about being having a cost, such a tremendous cost. The RAND study indicated it would run somewhere from $2.4 million to $8.4 million to cover all of the transgender-related health care for all of our service members for just a one-year period. And to put that in context, if you look at just a couple of transgender service members that I personally know, one is a doctor and one is an attack helicopter pilot. And we have probably spent $3 to $4 million in training just two individuals. So that when you talk about cost, surgical costs, health care costs, it really puts it in perspective.
We're talking about the transgender ban in the military. A federal court judge just blocked, or at least partially blocked, that ban. Sherry Swakowsky is with us, retired Army colonel from Wisconsin, the senior out transgender veteran in the country. Let's talk about this ruling from the judge now, Sherry. Saying mostly blocking, I've heard some people say basically entirely blocking the implementation of this memo. What do you see in this decision?
Well, I've heard it both ways as well. I'll start off by saying I wasn't really surprised by the ruling. It is a first step, but like I said, this thing has been studied for a year at least by the RAND Corporation and the Pentagon. And what they implemented when they changed the policy, they were very comfortable with it. This is a very constitutionally sound policy. And I think that's what we saw the judge rule. She indicated that the directive, I guess I'll call it, that Trump put out to reverse the policy and again ban transgender people really wasn't founded on facts.
The one part of the memo, that directive that the judge didn't specifically overturn anyway, was the ban on military funding for gender reassignment surgery. Some advocates are looking at one of the last lines saying, basically, we're back to the status quo. We're back to before this memo came out, something that people are reading both ways. What do you see in that?
Yes, there's definitely some confusion, and I think it deals with Trump's directive because he prohibited funding for reassignment surgery unless it's already in process. And there have been and there are that whole medical process has been started for many folks. So I'm thinking that surgeries are going to go ahead. It's not just reassignment surgeries we're talking about, but if you talk to a female to male transgender individual in the military, reassignment surgeries are, first of all, not wanted by everybody. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking female to male, they may opt for other things like mastectomies, hysterectomies, and those things are taking place. have taken place and will continue to take place. So I think it's more just the genital surgery, if you will, that is so concerning, so overly concerning, frankly.
And I've been reading around some reaction and comments to news articles, and one response seems to be, fine, no problem with transgender people serving openly in the military, but why not wait until leaving military service to do any of the medically related procedures? Don't do it on the taxpayer's time or dime, I guess is the comment I'm seeing out there a lot.
Two comments on that. Number one, I can tell you from my own experience that dealing with being transgender in the military and not being allowed to be authentic is a major distraction. I obviously did a couple of things correctly during my time to be promoted to colonel in a very competitive environment, but I often wonder how much better of an NCO and an officer I could have been had I been allowed to transition and live authentically. So, and I'm spacing your other comment, your other question here.
The cost, I think people are uncomfortable with too.
Yes. Why not wait mm-hmm. till after? And I think I just addressed that. But the cost is such a minuscule amount of the defense health budget, not just the defense budget, but the defense health budget. So I find it extremely difficult where you can justify providing some medical care, but not complete medical care. So it's like telling someone with clogged arteries that, well, you really need bypass surgery, but we're only going to do stents or something to that effect. It's a similar analogy.
Can you talk a little more about your experience in the military at a time when you couldn't be openly transgender in the military, and not if you wanted to keep your position?
Well, exactly. I was in the position, especially working for the government full-time, both as a federal civil servant and then as an active duty service member, that I knew better than most that being trans was would cost me the profession I loved, even though I sacrificed my authenticity, if you will, for those 3.5 decades that I served in uniform out of love and respect for not only my family, but the profession that I loved. And it was extremely difficult at times. I mean, there were very infrequent periods of living authentically where I would go out, buy clothing, dress appropriately for the way I felt that I always was. And then, you know, after a couple of hours or a day or two, it was purging all of those purchases and, you know, at least until the next time. And I always knew there would be a next time.
We're talking to Sherry Swakowski. She's a retired Army colonel and the senior out transgender veteran in the country. We're looking at President Trump's transgender military ban, just blocked this week by a federal judge.
And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234 on the Ideas Network Facebook page as well. What do you think of the block on the Trump administration's policy? Do you think that it goes too far or that it doesn't go far enough? If you're a current or former member of the military, we'd love to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Sherry Swakowski. She's a retired Army colonel and senior out transgender veteran in the United States. We're looking at a judge's decision to mostly block the White House ban on transgender service members.
And you can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or on our Facebook page. What do you think of the block on the transgender military ban? Do you think that gender reassignment surgery and medical needs should be covered by the military? If you're a member of the military, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Sherry, so this block is in place. What does this mean now? Where are we with the federal and military policy on enrollment of new transgender service members and the people who are already there?
Well, it means several things. First of all, it allows the people that are currently serving in uniform who just happen to be transgender, it gives them a little sigh of relief. They're okay for a little while. It also forces Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis to get with his service secretaries. You'll recall that we were supposed to start enlisting transgender civilians come the 1st of July. On the 30th of June, he push that back 6 months. So what that means now is that that date is back on. So civilians who have been stable in their gender for 18 months should be able to be enlisted into the armed forces come the 1st of January. And that accession part of it also affects people currently serving. Most people don't understand that. As an example, I have friends who have put in packets to go to leadership training courses, whether it be Officer Candidate School or Warrant Officer Candidate School. And those have been turned back to them without action, because when you graduate from such a course, you are discharged as an enlisted person and you are assessed as an officer. So they got caught up in this with all the civilians as well.
So are they kind of in limbo now, or are they out of it now that this has been blocked?
They are in limbo until the 1st of January. So the 1st of January, they should be able to have their packets go forward. Similarly, I have a great friend who's a graduate of the Naval Academy, spent 10 years on active duty with the United States Navy, was a rotary and fixed-wing helicopter pilot. She is in the reserves, and she is trying to get back in, and she also has had that pushback because of the six-month delay.
Were there people who, even after the ban had ended, said, I'm not going to go out there, I'm not going to put myself out there openly as a transgender person because I don't know if this is going to stick, if this is going to still be around?
I think there was a lot of that, you know, very similar to after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. I think we probably have less, or maybe 50% of the gay and lesbian people that are serving in the military out. And it's a much higher percentage, I'm sure, for the transgender population that's out there.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in La Crosse. Lisa, hi.
Hi, I'm ex-Army. I'm straight. Ben, I have a strong opinion. I'm in the VA system now, but I have a very strong opinion that if the military and the government or the VA is going to cover mental health services, period, then they need to cover all mental health services, not just pick and choose the ones they like.
Lisa, thanks for the call. And Sherry, I guess she's saying this would be part of covering the mental health needs of service members.
Well, exactly. And you can't just provide, let's say, hormone treatment and counseling without providing the surgical needs that those individuals require. I mean, we have, you know, the average transgender service person has 8+ years of service and 2 or more deployments. Transgender service members are in extremely important roles. They're company commanders, they're drill sergeants, they're special operators. We're on submarines. We're infantry officers and pilots and physicians. You know, so this is this is an important part, not large necessarily, but a very important part of our military strength.
Lisa, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Sherry Swakowski, retired Army colonel, looking at the transgender ban in the military that President Trump had signed as a directive a couple months back. Now a federal judge blocking most of that directive. Still time for you to share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. We heard from Jacqueline on Facebook who says the only question should be, can you perform your duty?
And that's exactly what Secretary Ash Carter said last June 30th when he announced a change in policy. He indicated that the things that are most important in getting the job done is an individual's ability and their character. And being transgender doesn't affect your ability to do that.
Thanks for that, Jacqueline. Do you see lessons from the past when it came to racial integration in the military, expanding the role of women in the military over the years? That was in stages, I think. Don't ask, don't tell. Are there lessons we could or you think should have learned?
Well, very definitely. You know, the president, when he tweeted out on the 25th or 26th of July, it happened to be the 69th anniversary of the integration of the military and President Truman's desegregation of the military. That same year, women were allowed to enlist for the very first time outside of wartime service and be paid the same as their male counterparts. So we progressed from there to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, all combat roles being open to females. And if the person can do the job, why shouldn't they be able to have any job they desire?
What kind of reaction have you seen in the military culture to openly serving transgender service members, apart from the transgender service members themselves, I should say?
Well, I can tell you that when the president came out with a tweet that many of the commands came to their transgender service members and called them in to reassure them, letting them know that three tweets does not a policy make, and that they had their backs. And that was very, you know, you rally around, you attack one of us, you attack all of us.
Let's bring on another caller now. Wes is with us in La Crosse. Wes, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I have an opinion about that myself, and what bothers me a little bit is when I joined the service, I had to be physically fit to join the service. I could not go in there and have them do an examination and say, well, if we give you operations of whatever kind, then we can make you fit at taxpayers' expense. And I think it's really unfair that someone can go in and say, well, I need transgender operation and have it done at taxpayers' expense when that's not afforded to other people. And when you say that it's only a small percent of the budget, well, that's a small percent that the other people are not allowed to exercise.
Wes, thanks for the call. What do you think, Jerry?
Yes, a couple of things. Number one, there is no path for transgender civilians to come into the military and then have surgery. The only way they can come into the military is to be stable in their gender for 18 months. That's what the directive talked about. And as far as, you know, the cost for it, again, they're really, how do you justify morally only treating a person partway for their medical condition? And that's what it is. It's no different than someone who has chronic heart disease or diabetes. It falls into the same category. It's a medical condition deserving of treatment.
Thanks for that call. And Sherry, as we start to wrap up, looking ahead, this is one judge blocking this. It's not, the court battles aren't done. The U.S. Justice Department is reviewing the ruling. It says it disagrees with it. What are you looking ahead to now as that progresses through the courts?
Well, I think it'll be an interesting time, but I guess I go back to my original statement that when this policy was put in place, it was a well-thought-out policy. And by well thought out, I mean that it was constitutionally sound. And I think that we're going to have other district, other circuit courts, judges come up with a similar viewpoint. And if we don't, it'll be, you know, it'll be taken higher.
If there's a transgender civilian out there, maybe just out of high school, say thinking, I want to enroll in the military, I want to enlist, but this is a big gray area. I don't know what's going to come out. What would you say to them?
I would tell them to continue to chase their dreams. If you want to enroll in the military, you should be able to do that starting the 1st of January, as long as you are stable in your gender and have been for the last 18 months.
And then finally, your thoughts for service members currently serving who are transgender who might be listening. What do you say to them?
Well, I would say that we've been there before. We've done this before. It was studied, you know, for a year. You know, that's twice the amount of time that Secretary Mattis has been allotted by the Commander-in-Chief for his new study. I personally don't think there's going to be a different outcome coming from the Department of Defense, and I say that because the service members and the leadership in the military knows the value of their transgender service members.
We'll leave it there for now. Sherry, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Big technology companies are in the news a lot lately. Social media companies are testifying before Congress, and Google had a big glitch today that almost destroyed some of our documents here at WPR.
But those companies have also entered into a lighthearted controversy over an emoji, specifically the one that looks like a cheeseburger.
observant technology fans noticed that the Google cheeseburger emoji had the cheese under the burger, while Apple, Facebook, and just about everybody else had the cheese on top of the burger. Google CEO Anand said he would investigate the emoji cheese placement.
I have thoughts on this one. I mean, once upon a time, I would have said, of course, the cheese goes on top, right? I mean, that just seems like the natural way to do it.
It does get melty on top.
Right. And as you have it on the burner, it's on top. But on one of our Food Friday segments, we talked to a sandwich expert who said for sandwiches, burgers, whatever, cheese on the bottom, it's going to hit your tongue first. You're going to get a stronger cheese flavor out of it. And I have put this into practice. I don't know if you... Where do you put your cheese on your sandwiches?
I completely forgot that bit of advice about cheese.
I key in on weird stuff.
As long as there is cheese, I'm on board. Let's just put it that way. But
true.
My one beef with putting the cheese on top is that sometimes it just melts. And so you've just got a tiny puddle of cheese instead of the full slice.
Well, all right.
So maybe the bottom.
I think we're agreeing to agree on this one.
I think so.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Where did cheese go?